This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As far as robbery goes, the theft of $17 million from the Charlotte branch of Loomis Fargo back in 1997 was spectacular. A spectacular comedy of errors, that is. One would think you'd have to be pretty smart to steal that kind of money from the vault of an armored car company, but it turns out that if you want to get away with it, you have to be brilliant. And that's where those who were in on the heist got into trouble. As one headline put it at the time, they took the money but forgot to run. And it didn't take the FBI long to trace the robbers' web of relationships to figure out who was involved, especially when the thieves themselves gave the Fed so much help. Seemingly bent on self-destruction, they either didn't find it necessary to get out of town or really wanted to show their friends what their unexplained newfound wealth would buy. So they stuck around to show it off. Pride goeth before the fall, and these hapless bad guys would soon fall into jail. At the time, Jeff Diamond was working in the Charlotte Observer's Gaston County Bureau. He kept readers up on the story as it developed right through the trial. Later, he wrote a book about it, Heist, the $17 million Loomis Fargo Theft. A movie was even made about this episode in Charlotte's history, Mastermind, starring Zach Galifianakis. We hear from the mastermind himself later in this program, but first we check back in with Jeff Diamond, who joined us originally in 2002 when his book was first published. Welcome back.
Thank you, Michael. I'm happy to be here.
Good to see you. What have you been doing in the interim? We talked in 2002. You'd already left the Observer then. You had moved to New Jersey to work for the Star-Ledger. What have you been up to?
So I stayed at the Star-Ledger in Newark, New Jersey, until around 2010. I started writing about religion in America, Islam in America, Catholicism. And then in 2010, I left journalism, and I entered a doctoral program in history. And I just finished my PhD in the history of Islam in America, which is a very different topic than the Loomis Fargo heist. And I just started working about a month ago at the Pew Research Center in D.C.
Wow. So you're moving up. Moving up.
Moving along.
I'm sure that when this story first crossed your desk at The Observer in 1997, you saw it as just another assignment, another day, another story to write. If that's true, when did it dawn on you that you might never see anything quite like this again?
Oh, well, you're right. When the story first broke, it was October of 1997, and it was a very big theft. You know, Loomis Fargo had lost $17 million, and everybody was like, wow, that's a lot of money. It's the second or third largest heist in America, cash heist in American history. And, you know, the media followed it for a few months, of course, and learned about a little bit about David Gant. I mean, it was kind of an amazing story then. But it wasn't until everybody got arrested in March of 1998, 5 months later, and all these details came out about how they had spent the money and how there was a murder plot involved and mobile homes into mansions and breast implants and things like that, that everybody knew this was a story for the ages.
Yeah, we'll go through some of the details as we talk here. But as it unfolded, did you think to yourself, my goodness, this is a gold mine? What did you think?
I thought that this was one of the most incredible stories I would ever cover in my life.
Has that turned out to be true?
Well, certainly, in terms of me being one of the lead reporters on it, without a doubt.
Because you've covered papal funerals, you've covered the aftermath of 9/11, you've covered...
I've covered things with much more international significance, certainly. The heist, of course, is never going to be in a history book of any type, other than the book that I wrote, most likely. But yeah, I mean, the thinking at the time was, you know, I was also the crime reporter for Gaston County around here. And when you tell people you're the Gastonia crime reporter in Charlotte, they buy you drinks and they want to hear all of your stories. And that had been true for decades before I came on, before I moved to the region in 1996. And I wound up covering like the Gaston crime story of all stories.
But this occurred in Mecklenburg County. That's what I don't understand about this, because
that's
Loomis
point,
Fargo's depot, I suppose, if that's what you want to call it, is on Settle Avenue, which is between West Moorhead Street and Wilkinson Boulevard, right down the street, literally right under WBTV. Mm-hmm. Why was it a Gaston County story? It's a Mecklenburg County crime.
That's a very good point. The reason people came to view this as a Gaston County story, or on the other side of the Catawba River story, is because virtually all the people involved, from David Gant to Kelly Campbell to Steve Chambers, were either from Gaston County or had spent time there, or they lived in Cleveland County. And so that's really the main reason, because of where the people were from. And it wound up fitting, you know, some of their behaviors were seen as fitting some of the negative stereotypes, you know, that that are part of the region.
Which we don't talk about anymore because the world has changed. Gaston County has changed. And so has Mecklenburg. So has Charlotte. 1997, 19 years ago, but a lot of things have changed in Charlotte since 1997. It was a very different city back then. We've had a lot of newcomers who are here who were not here then. So how would you describe both this city and how this crime meshed with the atmosphere of Charlotte back then?
Well, David Gant and the people who became involved in this lived in Gaston County, as I mentioned, and this has to do with Charlotte in a way I'll explain in a second.
Okay.
Charlotte, you know, had this excellent economy. People always would use the word gleaming and world class when they talked about Charlotte for all the reasons we've all heard a zillion
times. That hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed. I know. I follow the news, but there were people who were left out of that economic progress. And David Gant and Steve Chambers and Kelly Campbell certainly fell into that camp. And, you know, talking with David over time was one of the more fascinating interviews of my career. I remember him just feeling left out of all the progress and knowing people who he'd grown up with who he didn't feel had been as intelligent as he was, you know, who were having these good lives in Charlotte or in Gaston County. Because, you know, the stereotypes are just stereotypes. Gaston County is a very nice place, and you could you know, a lot of people do very well there, of course. And so David would see these people around him, and he would associate, you know, he felt like his parents had lived better lives than he had, and he didn't see any way out of his, you know, working hourly jobs for low wages.
Yeah, David is the fella who worked for Loomis Fargo. He was the guy who actually loaded the money onto the truck one night, the night of the robbery. And you write about the fact that he, as a child, grew up, and his mother would take him shopping at Sears and JCPenney. And he couldn't afford to shop at Sears or JCPenney. He could only afford Walmart, and he wanted more. He was making $8 an hour. 1997, I don't know what inflation is like since then. But
about $12.50 now.
Okay, so he couldn't afford to do those things. All he wanted to do was be able to shop at JCPenney.
And he talked to me about the anxieties that he felt, you know, on literally a daily basis.
Yeah.
You know, from when he packed his lunch, what he could afford to eat, when he put his clothes on, you know, what he could afford to wear. He told me he had to go to 8 different places to find a pair of cowboy boots he could afford that he liked. And then he told me, I remember the moment that he told me that he actually decided he was going to do it. It was when he tore open the monthly credit card bill, because back then we still lived in a paper society back then.
Right.
And, you know, the moment when he saw what the bill was for the month and he realized that if he made the minimum payments, it would take years and years to pay off. And he could barely afford the minimum payments. He could barely afford the minimum payments. And I thought that – I mean, I think everybody's had that moment of anxiety when you open your credit card bill. And
so let's be clear about David Gant. He was not a guy living above his means. He was a guy just trying to get along on what he was making at Loomis Fargo as a truck driver, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And you said he felt he was smarter than most of the people around him who were doing better than him. So what happened? Was he smarter? Is he smart? You know him.
David was – I would say David in certain ways is smarter than you would have expected, than somebody might have expected having made such a blunder to think that they can get away with this type of crime. He was a big reader in high school. He talked about Shakespeare. He talked about, I think, Greek mythology. And he clearly had a literary bent about him.
Did he go to college?
He did not go to college. He went into the Army.
Okay.
Which doesn't mean you wouldn't go to college, of course. Well, but his personal path was he wound up not going to college.
Okay. But he could have. He had the intellect to go to college, it appears.
He was smart enough to go to college.
Yeah. The movie Masterminds is a Zach Galifianakis film. And they say in the beginning of the film, I've only seen the trailer because it hasn't opened yet, in the beginning of the film, based on a true story. It's this story. But given the cast, Zach Galifianakis, Kristen Wiig, Jason Sudeikis, and several other Saturday Night Live alums. The wacky characters in this film will most likely be even wackier than they are or were in real life. So how would you describe the real people in this story?
Well, I think the real people in this story were, as I said before, frustrated that their lives were not what they hoped they would be. I don't mean to make them working class heroes here in terms of saying that. I'm just saying that they didn't really feel they felt you know, Steve Chambers, one of the main people in this, had been involved in petty crime for a long time before the Loomis Fargo heist. He had pled guilty to writing $30,000 worth of bad checks. There were other things as well. Kelly Campbell had worked at a Loomis Fargo security guard. That's where she met David. And then, you know, she was kind of going from one job to another, which, again, there's nothing wrong with going from one job to another, certainly. It's just that she didn't feel like she had any easy way out of her life. And mm-hmm. She lived in a mobile home that she wasn't very happy with, and as I think most of them did. So they were just, you know, and this wasn't like a long time coming necessarily. This is, you know, basically Kelly and Steve talking about this, you know, at a barbecue while, you know, over a game of Uno one day and, you know, beers in their hand and saying, hey, do you think we could pull this off? Steve says to Kelly, and she says, nah, it can't happen. And then they start talking about their connection to David, because Kelly knew David from Loomis. So it all kind of steamrolled from there.
I read your book when you were on this program in 2002, and I don't recall all what I recall of the book is that it was full of details. It read like a novel, but it's one of those situations where if this were a novel, it would not be believable. But I do remember chuckling throughout the book because some of the things are funny. They weren't meant to be funny. It's just a comedy of errors, to quote Shakespeare. That's what it is. Is it okay to laugh at this, do you think, whether it's the movie or your book or just the story itself, because no one got hurt?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the prime reasons people have laughed about this story since 1998. And the book has so many – there are so many fascinating details in this story. And just the overall narrative, I think, of the case itself. I mean, you have people who actually do the hard – who kind of do the hard part. They get the money in their possession. And then they completely screw up the part that everyone would think they should be able to pull off.
You have you were telling me that you have recently rewritten portions of this book since we talked last, and your publishers put it out again in advance of the movie to capitalize on the movie. But you say you've included even more details. You wanted to improve the book with more details. It's so chock full of details. Where were the details left out?
Actually, or fewer detail. I took out details because.
Okay.
When I wrote this the first time, it was 2002. Actually, I wrote it in 2001. The Charlotte region was still really talking about this crime a lot more than, you know, because it was still kind of new to everybody in certain ways. And I was also a reporter back then.
Right.
And, you know, having more details is something reporters like doing. They like to break new things. And it really captivated everybody around here. And I think I probably put in too many in 2002. And when I rewrote the book for 2015, in the current form, I focused more on the narrative and realized that you can, in fact, have too many details in a book.
So you have more of a 30,000-foot view now because you've been away from the story and away from Charlotte long enough to have a different point of view on the situation. We're going to continue our conversation with Jeff Diamond, who's the author of Heist, the Oddball Crew Behind the $17 Million Loomis Fargo Theft, which happened here in Charlotte in 1997. And when we come back, we'll also hear from a fellow we've been talking about, David Gant, the man at Loomis, who loaded the car with $17 million, or the truck with $17 million, and drove it off the lot. We'll come back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Our encore conversation on the Hillbilly Heist continues in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hollins University, dedicated to producing graduates with confidence, leadership skills, and drive. Whatever the career, research lab, classroom, or the stock exchange, Hollins works to provide the path. Hollins.edu. And from Our Town's Habitat for Humanity Restores in Cornelius and Mooresville. Restores offer donated household items to the public with proceeds used to build affordable homes in northern Mecklenburg and Iredell counties. Details at ourtownsrestore.org. North Carolina's new Attorney General, Josh Stein, has made opioid abuse an early top priority. North Carolina is seeing more and more deaths linked to prescription drugs and heroin, and Josh Stein will share his plan of attack for the epidemic. And we meet world-renowned tenor Marcello Giordani, who will be in town this month for Opera Carolina's season finale, The Girl of the West. That's when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, fresh tensions as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson readies to visit Moscow, from the Syria strikes to the investigation into Trump's Russia ties. Where is this relationship headed? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That conversation on Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Jeff Diamond, who is the author of Heist, the oddball crew behind the $17 million Loomis Fargo theft in 1997 here in Charlotte. He was at the time a reporter for the Charlotte Observer in their Gaston County Bureau. He now is going to work for the Pew Trust in
the Pew Research Center.
The Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. So you've kind of moved up in the world. Maybe the perpetrators of this crime have moved up. Have you been in touch with them since then?
I haven't been in touch with them too much. David used to send me emails every now and then, David Gant. I think, by and large, most of them just want to move on from this and see it as a period of their lives that, you know, doesn't define them. I think they did this. Most of them, they're only about 5 or 6 years older than I am. I was going to say was at the time, but that's still true. And most of them now are in their 40s or maybe early 50s, and they don't really want to have anything to do with this, with some exceptions. David was at – he did a lot of the – he went to a lot of the film shoots. I think I heard he was at the premiere in New York, and I did an interview for the DVD that's coming out about the movie, and David and Steve were both interviewed for that. But by and large, the people involved in this really want to move on. They wanted to move on right after this happened.
Well, lucky for them, or unlucky for them, as the case may be, this movie is going to get in the way of that, it would seem to me. The thieves themselves were often portrayed as cartoon characters, and their misadventures during the time of this heist, and their misadventures were sometimes referred to as the hillbilly heist because of some of the wacky, bizarre details of the case. And those details had all the makings of a good comedy movie. Masterminds is what it's called. It's a Zach Galifianakis film featuring many of the stars of Saturday Night Live. So you know that they've taken this true crime story and turned up the satire to 11. prior to the film's premiere, WFAE's Sarah D'Elia spoke to the actual mastermind, I guess, of the Loomis Fargo heist, David Gant, about that time in his life and about how those events have been portrayed in the film, portions of which you are about to hear. She started by asking him if the filmmakers had consulted him before they made their movie.
Oh, yes, they did. They contacted me probably almost a year before they started filming, and Zach Galifianakis wanted to talk to me before he would go forward. And so they invited me out to Los Angeles and went out, talked to him and Jared Hess. And he just wanted to kind of get a feel for the story and a feel for me. And what he really wanted to do was hear how I talk, hear my accent.
My name is David Gant. I always felt I was destined for a life of adventure. It didn't quite pan out that way.
There he is, the man of your dreams.
It's like you're marrying both of us, David, me and Mama.
How was it meeting him?
He is you know how most people think actors are going to be? He was the exact opposite. I was really shocked, and he's just a really nice guy.
So, have you seen the trailer for the film?
Yes, I have.
What do you think about the trailer and the movie based on that?
Oh, I think it's going to be great. I mean, one of the things I have said from the very beginning, mostly in jest, this is going to make a great comedy someday, and I guess it's coming.
That's great.
Then one day, I met Miss Kelly Campbell.
What would you do with $1 million?
Probably start my own business, maybe be a bounty hunter.
Nice.
You know, put a cap in their house.
Oh! Oh, that burns!
Oh, my gosh, David, let me see!
Oh, God!
I think that bullet just went straight between your cheeks.
Yeah, it feels like it just grazed my biscuits right there betwixt them.
So you're not anxious about it or anything like that?
Oh, I'm excited about it. I mean, yeah, it's going to be kind of self-depreciating humor on my part, but I'm a big boy. I can handle it. You know, I'm pretty sure they did a good job, and they invited me up to the set, and I got to see a bit of it getting made, and it was pretty impressive.
do you happen to keep in contact with anyone that was involved in your life during that period?
No, ma'am. When I got out, I realized I've turned over a new leaf, and I just went to put that behind me. And I didn't want to open up any old wounds or create any animosity towards anybody or with anybody. So I just kind of came down here and cocooned myself away.
Kelly tells me y'all work together over at Loomis. That strikes me as an incredible opportunity.
You talking about robbing a bank?
How hard can it be? You load up a truck.
I'm not dead!
And you drive away.
Do people where you live, do they know who you are?
Oh, yeah. My boss knows, and I told him when I first started here at the company I'm with now, I told him about the movie that was coming out, and he thought it was hilarious, too. But most people, the company I work for, they only look at me as for what I bring to the table, what skills I have, and what abilities I have. They don't care about, you know, what happened almost 20 years ago.
So you're not worried about being the butt of any jokes or anything like that?
I'm sure that's going to happen, and I've lived long enough that my skin is fairly thick, so I'm sure I'll survive it.
And I know it's been 20 years, which is quite some time. Do you think about that time and everything and how that happened and went down, or do you just kind of put it in the past?
I kind of put it in the past. I've got so many things going on in my life now that I don't really worry about it much.
Police are calling it one of the largest cash heists ever.
17 million missing.
Authorities are now searching for this man.
Look at him. Look like Kenny Rogers and Kenny Loggins had a love child. And then Kenny G, he just showed up to the birthday party, started playing the flute, and messed this boy up.
You mentioned that you're married now. What does your wife think about the movie?
Oh, she laughed. And she would just look at me and say, $17 million. And just like, she's got a really strong sense of humor. And she just thought it was hilarious. she can't believe that a person like me would do something like that.
Do you ever think back to that day and that period and think like, oh, if I would have done something different, I would still have all that money or anything?
Oh, I think everyone who commits a crime later on looks back and says, you know, if I'd have turned left instead of right, or if I'd have done this instead of that. But I look at it now that if I hadn't have done what I did in the way that I did it, I wouldn't have my daughter today and my life, you know, isn't spectacular. It's not terrible either.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't have a lot of the things I really treasure.
It's time to cut David Gant from the team.
We can't do this. This is wrong.
So, who y'all want me to kill?
Whoa! Not now, not in front of.
Is it one of them?
No.
Please go upstairs right now.
See y'all in a little bit.
When you think back to that point in your life when you made the decision to be a part and stealing the money, what was going on for you personally that made you decide that you'd be a part of that?
You know, thinking back on it now, it's been 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to sit down with a shrink or a psychologist or whatever, I would probably have been diagnosed with like depression of some sort. But oddly, I reinvented myself in prison, and I realized that person had to go away because he was just not good for himself.
Yeah. What do you hope that people learn from your story?
Oh man, that's kind of a deep question. I would like people to learn that you really don't know people until there's pressure on all of you. And that's when you learn more about yourself than the people around you.
Save Chambers, double cross me.
David?
Yeah, I'm right here, Sugar Bush, okay? Don't worry about a thing.
Oh!
Lord, that's a cheap door.
You gotta give me a 3 count next time.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
I just hope people and go and enjoy the movie. Because if you've been watching the news lately, there's been some bad crap in the news in the last, year?
Mm-hmm.
Go see the movie. Put your mind at ease for an hour and a half and just enjoy the movie and take a breath. I think the whole country needs to just step back and take a breath.
Sometimes the only way out is through.
So as you, Sarah D'Elia's piece with David Gant, one of the three masterminds of the Loomis Fargo heist in 1997. Jeff Diamond wrote the book about it. He's with us. As you listen to that, is that the David Gant you know?
That is very much the David Gant I know. Some people told me my portrayal of him was overly sympathetic in the book. And, you know, listen, there's no getting around the basic facts of the story. I mean, he stole $17 million. He abandoned his wife. He abandoned his family. Stealing is wrong. Abandoning your family is wrong.
Yeah.
In my encounters with him, after having learned that about him, you might have expected him to be a different type of personality than he actually was when you met him. And from the narrative of the case, I'm not sure how much this is made clear in the movie, but in the book, he was indeed, in terms of the other people involved, a sympathetic figure in how this all played out. They tried to kill him after he stole the money. He was basically, you know, living as the Observer reported at the time, you know, in 4 months after stealing $17 million, he's actually holed up in a hotel in Playa del Carmen eating M&Ms and listening to the Eagles all day. You know, which some may say isn't a bad life, but but you know, that's all he could do. He was scared that he was going to get killed. He knew that they were trying to kill him. He wanted to try to avoid getting arrested. He probably had the slimmest of hopes that Kelly Campbell would come down and live with him down there.
Let's talk about all of these people. There were three people involved, as you say, David Gant, Kelly Jane Campbell, and Steve Chambers. How can we talk about this? David worked briefly with Kelly at Loomis, and then she went and took another job. She knew, but he didn't know necessarily that she knew Stephen very well, and he did not know Steve at all until the night of the heist, correct? And didn't know his last name.
Yeah, there are a lot of things in the movie. Again, the movie's, it looks like it's an enjoyable time. Screenwriters, of course, have the liberties to change the narratives, the historical narratives,
right.
to do
well, what this they is want. A comedy. This is not a documentary.
Yeah, but the actual story itself. And the book isn't a documentary. It's a funny story.
Right.
You know, the actual story itself is a lot of fun because the story is just unforgettable. You know, David and Steve never met before the heist. They met for a brief period when David transferred the money.
Does that strike you as odd that you're going to steal $17 million?
This is one of my favorite parts of interviewing David. You know, my interview with David was one of the four or five most enjoyable interviews I've ever had, or my favorite, let's say memorable. Mm-hmm. At one point, I asked him that very same question: Why would you give someone after stealing this money? Why would you give it to somebody else? And he looked at me without a second's hesitation, and he said, "Teamwork." And I looked back at him and I said, "Teamwork?" And he said, "Yeah, teamwork." You know. And he goes, "I was in the military and I was always taught, you give me a team of five guys, I can go anywhere and I can do anything."
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, "Teamwork." And so it was, you know, that kind of tells you a lot there. The boldness of his act was coexisted with a naivete,
yeah,
really. And I think that comes out in the interviews that he does.
So although he describes himself in that interview with Sarah as being probably depressed at the time, and you talk about how anxious he was because of his inability to earn the living that he needed to earn to support his family, to support himself. What about the other two? Were they depressive? Were they? Did you talk to them?
I talked to Kelly in great detail. Kelly was in a marriage that she wasn't very happy with at the time. She was smoking a lot of marijuana, which she said impeded her judgment, and. You know, Steve Chambers, who I never actually met. I saw him testify in a trial. We had a very brief phone conversation. He was the one person who wouldn't actually talk to me during this, but everyone else kind of gave me virtually everything I needed. He's been described as a very smooth talker. I think the film, from what I've seen, depicts him as being just a cut or two above the others in terms of being slick and being able to convince people to do things. That's certainly how he was described to me back at the time. And when I've seen the trailer, Owen Wilson's portrayal of him seemed a little bit more to me, more like, and I haven't seen the whole movie, but in terms of general slickness,
yeah,
more like what he may have been.
So it wasn't really David's idea. He was working at Loomis. He needed money. He wanted a better life, but he didn't come up with the idea. It was Kelly and Steve's idea. They got together and hatched this and thought about him because he worked there still, right?
That's exactly right.
How did they talk him into doing it?
They talked him into doing it by having Kelly kind of lure the possibility in front of him that she was going to basically come down and live with him, and that, you know, she knew that he had a crush on her. That was really a big thing of this. But David was in love with Kelly.
Okay.
Right? Both of them were married to other people.
Right.
David wasn't very happy with his marriage, although I just want to say, well, that the movie portrays David's wife, what seems to me, in a negative way.
Yeah.
I think, and you know, to their credit, they give her a different name, but Tammy was absolutely devastated by this, and she was by no account was she someone who, you know, a person would run from the hills, you know, if they were your spouse. But David still had a thing for Kelly, but Kelly knew this, and she knew that she could use it against him to, number one, get him to steal the money, and number two, make him think he was going to get his one-third share because she was going to give it to him.
But you write about her in the book. When they first meet at Loomis, because at one point she was working there, he liked her. He liked her looks and sidled up to her and says to her, "If you give me a cigarette, I'll be your friend." How did she respond to that?
And her response, as she told to me, was, "I don't need any friends, but I'll give you a cigarette."
Now, why did that endear her to him? Why?
I think just a general look. It was, you know, the type of things that makes people, you know, things that attract people to one another.
So who came up with the details of the actual heist? Did he, after they talked him into doing it, did he plan it out?
Well, David certainly had expertise. He still worked there. Kelly had worked there too, but David was still doing it. And so David knew the ins and outs of the place.
And his job there was what?
He was basically a driver. What David did was he would basically load the trucks up, and then he would make deliveries to banks and other places that needed this type of money. And what's essential here is that there was – the rule of working there is that you're not allowed to be around the money by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, so you don't get tempted. It's also obviously a way for – you know, for the company, for security. And so David knew this rule. He also knew that on the night of October 4th, 1997, he would be working with a trainee who didn't really know the ropes, who didn't really know the rules that much. So David knew that if he let the trainee leave before he did, he would be there by himself. And so that night at the end of the shift, he left the door to the vault ajar. He went into his pickup truck, pretended he was going to leave, waved goodbye as the trainee drove away. Then he went back in. And the rest is Charlotte history.
I have to, you know, 1997 seems like a long time ago, but it really wasn't. And there were things like key cards, even in 1997, which would log your entry into a building and your exit to a building and any door you had to open. There were probably cameras. Don't they have cameras in vaults and around vaults and in the area where you move $17 million from the vault to the back of the truck? Aren't there cameras?
Well, yes, indeed there are cameras. There were three cameras.
Well, let's talk about that when we come back. Okay. I lost track of time here. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk about that because, to me, that's crazy. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
We'll get back to our encore conversation on the Loomis Fargo heist in a moment here on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. And from Opera Carolina, performing Puccini's The Girl of the West, a rare Western opera, on April 23rd, 27th, and 29th. Tickets at 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.org. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is preparing to visit Moscow amid questions about Russia's possible involvement in the Syria chemical attack and the ongoing investigations into the Kremlin's ties with the Trump administration. What is the U.S. relationship with Russia now? That's the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point with Tom Ashbrook. Charlotte Talks continues in a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
Behind every All Things Considered headline, there's a deeper story.
Well, you know, this is the most important case about prayer at public meetings since 2014.
That's when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that prayers before local board meetings in the town of Greece, New York, were legal, and that set a national precedent.
All Things Considered gets beneath the surface of the day's news. Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Loomis Fargo heist in Charlotte in 1997, in which three people got away, at least temporarily, with over $17 million. Jeff Diamant, our guest today, D-I-A-M-A-N-T, was a reporter for the Charlotte Observer back then and covered it extensively through the trial, and then later wrote a book which has now been re-released because of the movie Masterminds. The book is called Heist, the Oddball Crew Behind the $17 Million Loomis Fargo Theft. So in 1997, even though it was the age of the dinosaurs, there were still electronic card keys to log you in and out of doorways. I would assume that they had that at Loomis Fargo. There were certainly cameras guarding, showing who was going in and out of the vault, one would presume. And you say, yes, in fact, there were.
Well, when David stole the money, he made sure that when he left, he took the two security cameras that he knew about. Mm-hmm. What he didn't know was that there were actually three of them.
Ah.
So the next morning, when he was, you know, flying or already in Mexico, the managers at Loomis Fargo and the FBI were actually watching him, the video of him having stolen this money by himself. Because, of course, the video camera didn't really catch the other people because they were waiting in cars outside and they had a little caravan down to get the money away. But David was the only one caught on camera. Nobody else was on the camera. And he was methodically moving the money into the van.
So did he take a Loomis Fargo armored car when he left with the $17 million?
Yes, he took a Ford Econoline van that belonged to Loomis.
Okay.
Now, what they did was they also rented a van, I think it was from Budget, and they drove the Econoline van from Loomis to a place where this other van was, and they offloaded the money right off of Route 85.
Okay.
And then they put the Loomis van. They quickly realized that there wasn't enough room in the rental van to carry to store all the money David had taken.
$17 million. This probably takes up a lot of space.
Was it does.
Ones it, or twenties?
Well, that's a very good question because Steve Chambers had the presence of mind to say, "Leave the ones and fives in the van. Put all the bigger bills, higher bills into." And he also had the presence of mind to have the 55-gallon drums. Right, 55-gallon barrels that he put in the back of his van because he didn't want the money to be all strewn about his van because if the police pulled them over,
right.
That'd be the end of it right there.
Right.
So they didn't have as much room for the money in the rental van as they thought they would. So they basically abandoned the Loomis van in the woods, and they hoped somebody else would find it and drive it away and take the FBI off the trail. That didn't exactly happen, but they did leave about $3.3 million behind.
Wow. Because they couldn't, didn't have room for it.
They just didn't have room for it.
Did he not worry about leaving fingerprints behind? DNA? Was DNA a part of the investigation back then? Probably not. But did he worry about that?
That did not appear to be a main concern. David's main concern about getting caught was because he knew that he would be missing. And he knew they would know that he was missing.
Now, they went on to be – the two that stayed behind in Charlotte, Steve and Kelly, went on to be rather profligate with their expenditures. As you report, David went to Mexico. We'll talk about why he did that and kind of hid out for a while and did not enjoy the benefits of their heist, even briefly. But had they not been profligate, would the FBI have been on to them, certainly on to him because of the video?
The main problem they would have had is that David's colleagues at Loomis Fargo knew that he had been close with Kelly. They had told the FBI that David and Kelly had been dating, which wasn't exactly true. So the FBI went to talk with Kelly Campbell very early on, and they had a pretty good sense that there was something awry because of the way she was talking to them. But they certainly had nothing that approached proof. So the FBI knew that there was a connection between Dave and Kelly from the very beginning just by doing interviews. Kelly and Steve, on the other hand—
But why would they interview those people? Why did they even know who they were?
The Loomis employees? Well, the reason
well,
the FBI...
Kelly, why would the FBI know Kelly and Steve but when they weren't on the videotape?
Well, they knew of Kelly because right after the crime, when David was missing, the first thing the FBI did was they tried to find out, you know, who he was, who might have known about this. And so they interviewed everybody who currently worked at Loomis Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
And the other Loomis Fargo employees told them that, yeah, David knew this woman, Kelly Campbell, who used to work here. So the FBI is on to Kelly Campbell, and they start interviewing her and trying to follow her around. And through surveillance and purchases with Steve Chambers, they co-signed, I think, a loan for a minivan, and they were just, you know, making their phone calls were – they were making phone calls to one another. But then you make a good point. Had they not started spending so much money and getting confidential informants to point it out – It might have been a different story.
Well, Steve Chambers moved after the crime from a mobile home to a $635,000 house on Kramer Mountain in Gaston County. He had no job, and he paid for the home mostly in $20 bills.
Most people usually, when you buy a home, and people talking about buying something in cash, what that means is you're not taking out a loan for it. Steve actually he brought two briefcases full of cash. You know, he wound up using cashier's checks, but the idea of paying in cash means something different.
Did that not tip off the real estate agent in any way?
It tipped off a few people, actually, but it didn't really go where it should have.
And Kelly bought this new minivan after the crime, and they caught her, too, because of how she registered that vehicle, but also because she made large deposits of cash at the bank, took a briefcase full of bills up to a teller and asked, how much can I deposit before I have to fill out government forms?
That was actually Michelle Chambers, Stephen's wife.
Okay.
And she would take, you know, and when the teller told her $10,000, Michelle at one point took $9,500, gave it to her. And when the teller looked a little bit, let's say, concerned, Michelle said, oh, don't worry, it's not drug money. Which, of course, led the teller to fill out the type of report that Michelle was trying to avoid in the first place.
Ah, so you can't crime does not pay. You can't get away with it. What about the digital tracks that we leave in our life? Were they wiretapping these people? I mean, were they following their phone calls in any way?
Well, this is obviously a very different era than the post 9/11 era in terms of things. People didn't use smartphones. Surveillance was a different thing, but the basics were still there. They were able in the final in the early weeks of the investigation they had what were called pen registers which follow your phone calls. Not they don't actually record them, but they know who's calling who, who called who. Later on in the investigation, when they got more evidence, they were able to actually get wiretaps.
So now the deal was that David, who actually physically stole the money, was going to leave most of the money behind and go to Mexico, and they would send him infusions of cash and eventually come there. Kelly was going to come there because he was in love with her, and he thought she was in love with him, and they would then have the cash. How did they think that was going to happen? How were they going to get $17 million over the border?
Well, this is actually one of the fun parts. The fun parts of the movie. Not so much fun for David Gant. Steve basically hired a hitman named Mike McKinney to go to Mexico and try to, you know, give David small amounts of cash at a time. By small amounts, I mean, you know, $10,000, $15,000, sometimes less. David thought he was going to. David assumed that it was going to be a priority of Steve and Kelly to get him his 1/3 share as soon as possible.
Right.
But instead, he's getting, you know, these smaller cash drops from a mysterious man named Mike McKinney.
Why did they even bother with Mike McKinney giving him $10,000 here, $10,000 there? If they sent him to kill him, why did they just kill him?
Well, because first of all, they didn't want David to. They felt that if David didn't get his money, he might go to the FBI. First of all,
yeah, but if you're going to send a guy down there with $10,000 and a gun, why not just use the gun and keep the $10,000?
They didn't send. Well, you know, they weren't sure that they were going to be able to get McKinney to kill him.
Ah, and McKinney ended up liking him.
McKinney ended up what happened? Yeah, they developed a sort of rapport. I don't know if McKinney actually liked him, but McKinney was basically trying to spend the money himself. McKinney would go down there with $10,000 or $20,000 for Dave, spend a portion of himself in Cancun's nightlife, give David what was left. David would be upset, and eventually they found and McKinney had no idea what David had done. He thought it was, you know, he agreed to kill David only because he thought it was like some type of, you know, he was just on the – he was hiding out. Nobody really cared about him.
Yeah.
When at one point they're drinking – they're sharing drinks on a hotel roof in, I think, Cozumel. And David says, you know how I got this money, don't you? And McKinney says, no, I have no idea. And then David tells him. And McKinney told me that at that precise moment – he realized that the FBI was going to be on this very soon and that he was going to be arrested at some point.
The FBI was on this. They were at one point listening into the phone calls between David in Mexico and Kelly, correct?
Yes. At the very end of this, after the FBI had, in their final weeks of freedom, after the FBI had were certain that Steve and Michelle Chambers and Kelly were spending Loomis Fargo money, the FBI still had a problem. They didn't know where that money actually was, and they didn't know where David Gant was. So they figured that wiretaps would allow them to find this all out, and sure enough, they did.
Yeah.
But you know, this was a pre-smartphone, so they were basically following payphones.
And at some point, David discovered that Kelly and Steve were trying to have him killed, or were planning to have him killed. At what point did he discover that? Was he still talking to Kelly, still wooing her to come down? Still, because he would say on the phone, "I love you," and she would not respond in kind.
That is correct. At some point, again in these final weeks, David learned that they were trying to kill him, and he learned this because Mike McKinney, the hitman I mentioned before, was played by Jason Sudeikis in the movie. He actually, once he realized that he was going to get in trouble for this after David told him what he did, he actually subcontracted the murder out to some local hoodlum in Mexico, in Cancun, I think, a guy who he told me was named Robert. And so just as Steve had arranged meetings between McKinney and Dave, McKinney starts arranging meetings between Dave and Robert. And Robert basically sympathizes with Dave. David claims this is because he was wearing a Pittsburgh Steelers jersey on one of their meetings, and Robert was a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. And so David knew that they were trying to kill him, and he starts to distance himself from McKinney, by the way, whose nickname was Bruno.
So when the FBI finally comes to Mexico, who arrests him, Mexican police or a combination of Mexican police and the FBI?
The Interpol was basically Interpol in charge of it, but there was an FBI agent named Mark Rossi who was basically, you know, trailing the Interpol folks, and they find David with a bag of laundry in Playa del Carmen one day, and they surround him, and they say, "Are you David Gant?" And he basically uses a fake ID. He basically tries to say, "No, I'm Mike McKinney," because he had been using Mike McKinney's fake ID. And they say, "That's not true, is it?" And at that precise moment, David's not sure if he's going to get killed or what, because he knew that people were trying to kill him. He sees the FBI agent, and he says, "Please tell me you're with the FBI." And he gets arrested, because he was actually happy to see an FBI agent at the time. He was so nervous he was going to get killed.
They put him on a plane
to
bring him back to America. He waives his Miranda rights. And they ask him, "You know, we've been listening into these phone calls, and you say I love you, and she doesn't. What's up with that?" They only kissed once.
And as David told the FBI agent, it was a pretty expensive kiss.
Let me share some thoughts that have come in as we've been talking here from listeners. Bill from Matthews. He says, "I shot a story for NBC News right after the Loomis heist, and we interviewed the mayor of Cramerton along with a couple of other area folks. We visited the home where the money was stashed and watched as the feds removed containers full of money. Apparently, the real estate agent had accepted cash for the property when it was purchased, and neighbors and the occupant had told them that he was a former football player with the NFL. Does this hold up, no pun intended, with the information you collected? And also, isn't Zach Galifianakis originally from Wilkes County?"
That's true. Zach Galifianakis, I believe, is from North Carolina. I forget. I didn't know which county he was from. The football story does, in fact, hold up to what I heard. Steve Chambers had told people that he was a former player in the Cowboys. This was before the age of Google, when people could check that thing out, that type of thing out in, you know, 3 seconds.
I think we were using Alta Vista back then. Dennis on Facebook, the ring. Oh, by the way, speaking of the house, because he brought up the house, the guy put leopard or tiger carpeting in and had a velvet Elvis painting on the wall.
Yeah, there were several furnishings of the house that were made fun of later. In their defense, to people who thought it was not of the highest taste, much of it had been there before they moved in.
Okay.
But they certainly embellished it in their own right.
Didn't have enough money to redecorate, totally. Dennis on Facebook writes, the ring of perpetrators were not the only ones jailed for the heist. A Gastonia lawyer spent time in federal prison when a couple of the gang members wanted to pay cash, real green bills for a home at Kramer Mountain. They had to find a lawyer to handle the closing. He should have known better. In fact, you say, there's, 21 people involved in this?
Yeah, there were 21 people. So Steve Chambers had a big problem being in control of all this money.
Yeah.
Because he was the one in control. He had to actually hide it somewhere and keep it where he could access it. So the first thing he does is he puts it in storage facilities around Lincoln County and Gaston County, you know, with a key and everything where you're the only one with access. Except that through a crazy way, from one of his cousins who was helping him with this, he actually had $1.5 to $2 million of that stolen. So then he starts enlisting his relatives to open safe deposit boxes, telling them that it's gambling money and not Loomis Fargo money, and paying them between $10,000 and $100,000 to store this money in safe deposit boxes. So there wind up being about 21 people charged.
Did everybody go to jail, or just some of them?
Some of them went to jail. Some of them went to prison. Their sentences were not as long as they might have otherwise been because there was no actual violence involved in this.
So David is out. Are Steve and Kelly out?
Steve and Kelly have been out probably – they've all been out for probably about 6 or 7 or 8 years now.
And it sounded like that one of the reasons for prison, which is rehabilitation, at least worked for David. has all the money been recovered? Did Loomis Fargo get it all back?
The vast majority of the money has been recovered. For a long time – there was $2 million missing, but they actually found that out in Colorado in a second trial that happened around 2003.
But some of it was spent, wasn't it? How do they recover that very quickly?
Basically, all these people have to pay restitution for the rest of their lives and for a long time.
They'll have to rob Loomis Fargo to be able to do that. Jeff Diamond, the author of Heist, the oddball crew behind the $17 million Loomis Fargo theft. Good to see you again. Congratulations on your success.
And thanks so much, Mike. It's been a pleasure.